Welcome to the Fermentation Speaker Series from the Center for Human Microbiome Studies at Stanford University School of Medicine. I am Aliza Caffrey, a graduate student in the Sonnenberg Lab here at Stanford.
I'm David Zilbert, a chef, food scientist, and author specializing in fermentation.
I'm Justin Sonnenberg, professor of microbiology and immunology at Stanford, and my lab studies the gut microbiome.
Our goal is to open up conversation around the current understanding and knowledge in the fermented food research space, and to define and promote future fermented food and health projects.
Probiotics and fermented foods are often clumped into the same category. Lactobacillus delbrueckii, subspecies bulgaricus, keeps coming up again and again. Ilya Metchnikoff thought that it was responsible for the longevity of people in the Balkans and introduced this idea that his microbe would seed the gut with healthy bacteria and help stave off pathogens and disease. Now we know it's more complicated than that. This idea of seeding or engraftment of food microbes into the gut microbiome of adults is not as common as Metchnikoff once assumed, but it did launch the concept of probiotics. But probiotics had also been isolated previously. Lactobacillus acidophilus was actually first discovered in 1900, and strains were isolated from the human oral, intestinal, and vaginal microbiomes before characterization, identification, and commercialization. Lactobacillus rhamnosus was similarly originally isolated from fecal samples of a healthy human adult, and is now one of the most widely used and studied probiotic strains on the market. Bifidobacterium bifidum was also isolated from the human gut from a baby, I believe, in the 1980s. Bacillus coagulans, now actually called Hendrixia coagulans, was originally isolated from Japanese green malt and has subsequently been used and isolated from soil, feces, and dairy products. It's a spore-forming lactic acid bacteria, which means it tends to have a long shelf life because it forms spores, basically vegetative cells, seeds, if you will, formed in the hopes of a brighter day, and allows people to claim that their products contain live microbes. Other spore formers include B. clausi and B. subtilis, for example. Saccharomyces boulardii, a non-pathogenic yeast and one of the only probiotic yeasts on the market, was originally isolated from fruits like lychee and mangosteen in 1923.
Yeah, so it's super interesting, the spectrum of things out there that are probiotics, a lot of them isolated from the human gut and from the environment. You know, the OG probiotic was isolated from fermented food, and I would have guessed there's a greater number of strains coming from fermented foods, particularly lactic acid ferments that everybody knows and loves, things like yogurt and sauerkraut and things like that. But it brings up this question of what actually is the definition of a probiotic. You know, everybody's always talking about fermented foods contains probiotics. And that, I think, isn't technically the case when it comes to the formal definition that has been embraced by a lot of scientists. And this is a definition that's been put out there by an organization called ISAP, International Scientific Association of Probiotics and Prebiotics, and they put together a consensus statement that was actually co-authored by today's guest, Maria Marco, and many other leaders in the field. And it's a thoughtful way of thinking about what should actually have the label of probiotic. We can't just take every supplement and every fermented food and say, oh, that has probiotics, because then the word kind of becomes meaningless at that point. So Maria and then other guests that we've had on this show, Paul Cotter, Ben Wolf, and other people define probiotics as live microorganisms that when administered in adequate amounts confer a health benefit on the host. The microbe must be alive at the time that it's administered. It must be taxonomically defined, so you have to know what it is, and then you also have to have the genome sequence available. And then in a trial in humans, you have to show that there's a health benefit in some way. So of course, this is, you know, a level of stringency that, you know, most bacteria and other microbes that are present as probiotics in the supplement store, most fermented foods just haven't been held up to this scrutiny. So I think it doesn't mean that they don't have probiotic qualities, but they just haven't been tested in a way that meets this formal definition.
Totally. And that's in contrast to food fermentation, which are just foods made through desired microbial growth. And so in that case, there's going to be the food along with microbes and nutrients and chemical products of fermentation that are called metabolites. And so there's some cases in which microbes that are probiotics are the same species that we see in fermented foods like L. reuteri or L. punterum. L. dulbrechii was originally isolated from yogurt. But what is important to note is that probiotics are defined by the strains, not just the species. So you could have L. punterum in sauerkraut, but that doesn't mean that it is a probiotic strain of sauerkraut, because it might be, especially through spontaneous fermentation, a strain that has not been characterized and has not been defined in terms of its health benefits. And so typically, foods and supplement labels can actually help you identify if there's a strain present, not just a species, by having the name of the strain itself, and then will be followed by a few letters or numbers that identifies the strain. And so you should be able to search for that specific strain that you'll find on a bottle or on a food, for example, and actually be able to look at the research. And I think yogurt is one of the few foods that we can say is a probiotic. It's typically made with strains that have been well characterized as probiotic strains. But it does get harder for fermented foods because, like sauerkraut and kimchi, rely more on wild or spontaneous fermentation. Or even like kombucha, where we don't necessarily have a well-defined community, even though we have a reliable starter that we can use, it's harder to actually be able to call these. In fact, you can't call them probiotics necessarily, even though they may contain live microbes.
And so tell me, your research specifically in the lab is really focused on kind of, you know, properties of fermented foods that maybe probiotics don't have. If you buy them in, you know, pill or capsule form, maybe you want to talk just a minute about kind of this major difference of fermented foods versus the very same microbe found in a capsule.
Yeah, so I'd say the biggest difference is that when you're consuming a food, you're also consuming all the nutrients and all the metabolites and chemicals produced during the fermentation process. And when we think about research that has been developing around fermented foods and health, there are a number of metabolites that have been shown to have important effects, for example, on the immune system. And so when you're consuming a probiotic, you're getting that microbe, but you're not necessarily getting the addition of the metabolites because that fermentation process can't happen because the microbes are on their own. And in addition, you know, you have the food matrix when you're consuming the food, and that might have a protective effect for the microbes themselves. So it helps them get past the stomach acid. And we see that a lot in kind of probiotics where there's a lot of research being done on figuring out the best delivery mechanism, or you might have a probiotic that is well characterized, but kind of guaranteeing that it will actually make it through safely to your small intestine or large intestine, wherever it should take effect, is challenging. And in fact, there's a study at Stanford that found that when you take an antacid, for example, it might help with probiotic delivery because it will help to increase your stomach pH and make it less acidic. And so it increases the likelihood that that probiotic will actually make it past your stomach and have some sort of benefit. So food ends up being a much more reliable way of delivering microbes, just because you also have that food matrix and nutrients that come along for the ride with the microbes. And I think yogurt is a very good example of this again, where you can use this well-defined probiotic strain to make a yogurt, and then you end up getting the best of both worlds. You get these defined probiotics, you get the metabolites, and also you have an increased likelihood that the probiotics will make it past the stomach. Then, of course, we have to understand that these purported benefits will actually have an impact on the individual. So looking at what is your body and how does it respond to consuming these probiotics? How does your gut microbiome respond to consumption of these probiotics? How does your body absorb nutrients? And kind of understanding how all those pieces interact will actually help us get at how to make a good probiotic or a good fermented food that will deliver the most benefit to you.
And so when you go into a supplement store and you see a bottle that's labeled probiotic, or if you see a fermented food that says contains probiotics, what are you guaranteed by those labels?
I think it probably comes down to the difference between the European compared to the American market. So in the US, there isn't any regulation around probiotics. As far as I understand, there's no FDA regulation, and they're considered a dietary supplement. So there's no one actually checking what is in your probiotic pills. And so even if you want to benefit, being kind of wary of the source of your probiotics is really important. And there is also a defined list of probiotic strains that have been well characterized. And so only because there says there's a microbe on a bottle of pills, it doesn't mean that they're high quality or that they're the exact probiotic that has been defined and well characterized. But in fermented foods, other than yogurt, you're not actually getting a defined probiotic that meets the definition that's set by ISAP. You are getting microbes that have produced a number of metabolites through the fermentation process. And they might be pasteurized or they might be unpasteurized eating a raw fermented food, but you're still going to get some of that benefit of the actual fermentation process. And then, of course, there's also this growing market of foods that are considered, you know, gut-friendly foods that might have been produced not through fermentation, but have a probiotic like B. coagulans or some other lactic acid microbe that is very shelf-stable at the end of production in order to confer some sort of probiotic benefit and to be able to kind of put a probiotic label on it. But those are separate from fermented foods. So it's important to be aware that there are foods that are either produced through a fermentation process that do not have a defined strain added to them, like kimchis or kombuchas. There are fermented foods that have been made using a defined probiotic, like some yogurts. And then there are also foods that are not fermented, but have an added probiotic, like some probiotic sodas, for example. And so being able to kind of clearly differentiate between these three groups has been made very challenging, especially with the rise of kind of this gut-friendly label. And so being kind of aware of what to look for is really important.
Okay, so clearly this is a very complicated topic. Two notes. One is you actually, Aliza Caffrey, have a forthcoming piece on defining fermented foods or helping people navigate how to determine what they might find in the marketplace, whether it truly is fermented or is something that's kind of a faux fermented product that manufacturers have made. Listeners should search out there for that in the coming months. And then the second one is our guest today, Maria Marco, is the perfect person to help us unpack all of this. So I'm really looking forward to the conversation.
Today's guest is Dr. Maria Marco. Dr. Marco is a professor in the Department of Food Science and Technology at the University of California, Davis. And her work is primarily on lactic acid bacteria in food systems and the mammalian digestive tract. Maria, thanks so much for joining us. I've been a big fan. I'm very excited to have you on. But before getting into it, do you mind telling us how you got into studying fermented foods?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for the invitation. It's really a pleasure to be here with you. I got into fermented food actually from a different angle, not working on the foods directly, but instead from the angle of investigating how probiotic lactobacillus can adapt or respond to the conditions it experiences when we eat it, and it's in our digestive tract, think about how probiotics could work in improving our health. What we found is that lactobacillus is metabolically active. It adapts to the environment in the gut. And actually, that's how I met Justin years ago, his work on that angle of lactobacillus. It wasn't actually until I started my faculty position at UC Davis that I got immersed in fermented foods and thinking about them. And well, I guess the rest, as they say, is history.
And Maria, it's great to see you again. I mean, I think back to the first time I met you when we were both trainees. I was in Jeff Gordon's lab at WashU in St. Louis. And I think you were at the Wageningen then, at least working with Mikhail Klerebezum to some degree. And then doing some in vivo experiments with lactobacillus and notobiotic mice. And those are, anyway, really fun memories of back to, I think, when we were both kind of learning the basics of the field of the gut microbiome.
Yeah, thanks for that. I'm happy to jump in to talk about that more because those couple of weeks I spent with you in the Gordon Lab, I got the flu. And I was so sick for half of that time. But yeah, I really appreciated your guidance even then when we were trying to extract RNA out of intestinal contents from those mice and running into all kinds of roadblocks, but we're able to easily extract RNA out of conventionally raised mice. And I think it's something to the high fat diet. And anyway, it was a simple solution, but didn't expect to encounter those hurdles. And it was really, you know, fond memories, although sitting in my hotel room feeling awful was not fun.
Yeah, that's awful, especially when you've been waiting to go to see the, you know, a group that's going to facilitate the set of experiments. I remember the frustration, but I will say it resulted in a beautiful paper that was, I think, a landmark at that point. And, you know, even at that point, I think we thought of you as an expert in lactic acid bacteria. Since that time, you know, you've really expanded your expertise and research in this area. It's been really exciting. This podcast, we've, you know, covered a lot of ground with previous guests. We've studied, you know, or talked about fermented food microbiome from the perspective of community ecology, filamentous fungi, global fermentation trends. But what's amazing is we haven't yet talked about the lactic acid bacteria. And when I think about fermentation, you know, this is what I think about. I think about the microbes associated with yogurt or fermented veggies. And so I'm wondering if you could just start by giving us and the listeners a crash course in this group of bacteria, their role they play in different fermentations, and why it's such an exciting group of bacteria.
Yeah. Well, what's there not to love about this group of microbes? I'm hooked. Yeah, and I'll interject my own opinions here that saying, like, I really didn't even appreciate or learn them in my coursework as an undergraduate at Penn State. And, you know, so there's some history here and even how I landed on this group. But the more I learn, the more excited I become. You may not know, but Lactococcus lactis, this lactic acid bacterial species, was the first microbe to ever be isolated in pure culture by Joseph Lister in the 1870s. It's called Bacterium lactis at that time.
Amazing. What was the source? Where did he culture it from?
Milk.
Milk. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Lister is so important in the history of microbiology and aseptic surgery. And but, you know, it's much more than Listerine. And then, you know, that sort of formative time in the science of microbiology, important figures like Eli Metchnikoff, who got a Nobel Prize in immunology for work in immunology, put forward this idea that the microbes in yogurt can help us live longer by killing off the putrefactive, the disease-causing microbes in our intestine. And if you'll indulge me, just another example, in the early 20th century, so 1920s, you have some of the very first human studies being published. And these studies were on Lactobacillus acidophilus, where they looked at constipation, diarrhea, eczema, mental health, consuming Lactobacillus acidophilus, and they found benefits. So, you know, from the medical side, they're important. From the food side, as you brought up, obviously very important. And our ancestors recognized this tens of thousands of years ago when they started the practice of fermenting foods. And as you explained, Justin, you go into any fermented food, there's going to be some component of lactic acid bacteria metabolism. Particularly, they're going to be abundant when you have a food that's high in simple sugars, monosaccharides, disaccharides. And so, you know, so much of our science we have has come from studying fermented foods, fundamental insights like isolating the first bacterium to the contributions of lactics in yogurt to establishing CRISPR, and these immune systems and gene editing came from Streptococcus thermophilus in yogurt. So I don't expect these insights we gain scientifically and practically are going to end anytime soon, study of this group of microbes. But I would be remiss if I didn't give some sort of definition or scientific terminology to help us define lactic acid bacteria. They're in the order Lactobacilles, and they're really kind of defined by their production of lactic acid as the main end product of their mainly fermentative metabolism. And one other thing I wanted to say is that we've been doing a lot of dives into taxonomy related to phylogeny across a different phyla of bacteria of recent years, and Lactobacillus has been in that mix, and a really important paper came out a few years ago now reclassifying Lactobacillus. We're finding like new species of Lactobacillus all the time, and it was getting crazy. So there were over 260 species of Lactobacillus prior to 2020, and based on genome sequencing, sequences across different species, it became clear that these are not really species, but different genera. And we now have 25 genera, where we had before one genus, Lactobacillus, 23 of which are new genera. So it's confused many, and they're tongue-twisting names, but it's really appropriate to describe the diversity of this group.
Awesome. That's a great intro, and we'll hit on several of those points in more detail as we move through this. One of the things that I love about microbiology is all the geeky terminology that you run into when you're studying microbes, like chemolitho organotroph, or words like this. And two of the words that you come across when you're thinking about Lactobacillus is homo fermentation and heterofermentation. And I'm wondering, you mentioned lactic acid, if you could just kind of differentiate those two for the listeners.
Because so much of how we define and understand this group of microbes, understanding their basic metabolism and how they acquire energy and carbon, we have these two distinct metabolic pathways we call homofermentation and heterofermentation. Homofermentation essentially uses glycolysis for as the main way for acquiring ATP through substrate phosphorylation and acquiring carbon for the cell. When a microbe is performing homofermentation, they'll end up with lactic acid as the sole metabolic end product. So reducing pyruvate to lactate that's released from the cell. For heterofermentative lactic acid bacteria, this is a distinct phylogenetic clade of lactobacilli, and then we have other genera that are able to perform heterofermentation. They don't use glycolysis, but rather a pathway, it's called the phosphoketolase pathway. And this results in different metabolic end products. In addition to lactic acid, you'll have acetic acid, diacetyl ethanol. And so this, of course, has very practical applications if we think about a food fermentation.
Awesome. That's great. And I think it connects to a lot of the other themes that we've been talking about, which is, quite often fermented foods are reduced to their major fermentation end products, but so often there's so many other molecules that are being produced. There's kind of the subdominant fermentation end products, and then all these other small molecules that are being produced. And, part of Elise's project in her PhD is using metabolomics to help define these. So, I think we're just kind of at the tip of the iceberg of understanding the chemical novelty in all the fermented foods out there. So connecting that to some of your group's recent work and also the comment about the new genera that Lactobacillus has been divided into, could you connect what you just mentioned about fermentation to your work on Lacti Planibacillus plantarum's ability to engage in hybrid fermentation?
Well done, Lacti Plantibacillus plantarum.
Which used to be just Lactobacillus plantarum, much easier to say.
Yeah. Honestly, I've practiced these words. the one I really had to practice was Lactobacillus sanfrancinthensis.
Yeah, that's...
It's a tongue twister.
No, I know. And you get up in an auditorium to try to give a talk, and that rehearsal time really pays off. It's time well spent. Yes.
It does. Oh, thanks for the question. This is a really exciting area. As I mentioned, although we've known about these microbes since sort of the advent of the techniques we have in microbiology as a science, we're still discovering really fundamental properties. Another example is that in the early 2000s, it was discovered that these bacteria respire. But this hybrid metabolism is yet another tool in the toolbox that these bacteria possess to be successful in very competitive environments. Thinking about differences between respiration and fermentation, you know, fermentation pathways result in very little cellular energy or ATP, whereas aerobic respiration, right, we're bucket loads of cellular energy by comparison. And so why have these bacteria really evolved to be using this inefficient metabolism? There are going to be these hybrid ways that bacteria and other microbes have to be successful in their environments. This hybrid metabolism is what we call a blend between respiration and fermentation. So it incorporates elements of, you know, the benefits of respiration, for example, in maintaining intracellular redox status. On the other hand, not relying on proton monophores for ATP synthesis and mainly getting increased cellular energy through fermentation. And in a nutshell, it relies on extracellular electron transfer. And you think about it, it makes a lot of sense because these bacteria are redox limited just by the way fermentation pathways work. If you don't have a good NAD-NADH ratio, you're in trouble. So what's fascinating is that EET, or extracellular electron transfer, was really for a long time thought to be only possible in gram-negative bacteria and is really... classified in sludge microbes, microbes we find in the soil, like Geobacter, Schuonella. But when we saw that Lactobacillus or Lactiplantibacillus plantarum can generate electricity, reducing a polarized anode, that was like, it was so cool. So showing that a gram-positive microbe is able to do this, you know, there's been others before us with Sam Light's great work, University of Chicago, with Listeria. So it was really through kind of, say, of a related microbe, Listeria monocytogeny, showing that it has this capacity for extracellular electron transfer. And the same sort of genes are in other lactic acid bacteria like L. plantarum that set off this set of experiments to explore EET in these fermentation driven microbes.
A wonderful, if very technical explanation. I'm probably the least the least chemist in the group, but I was following along a little bit, but nonetheless amazing to learn about these microbe superpowers. And yeah, what's the world coming to when Pluto is no longer a planet and Lactiplantibacillus is no longer Lactobacillus? Now this is all so fascinating, but I kind of want to widen the view here a little bit and zoom out. You've been, you know, super prolific in publishing on ways to reconsider the relationship between microbes and human health, you know, going back to the dawn of probiotics with Metchnikoff, including your work with ISAPP, the International Scientific Association for Pro and Prebiotics. And specifically, I want to talk about that consensus statement on fermented foods that was published in 2019. What distinction did the body make that helped define the difference between probiotics and fermented foods, if there is one?
You know, ultimately, I think it's a situation where we're constrained by terminology, and the number of ways we have to describe beneficial microbes and their impacts. A probiotic is a very specific microbe, and what I mean, even not just species, down to the level of strain. Just as you and I look different, so too would two different isolates of a bacterium we get out of an environment. And really, there is no limit to the diversity of strains. So these subspecies level differences between microbes, right? A probiotic is a strain that has been shown to confer a health benefit. And unpacking that, you know, you'd have to have at least one, preferably more, human studies where that specific organism was investigated. And it can be for any number of endpoints. And so that's when we think about a probiotic and the way that science has developed, we would need that type of information. For fermented food, which has many microbes, and in fact, we talk about fermented foods with lactic acid bacteria and different lactobacilli, they're going to be genetically related to the probiotic strains that we have available, but they're different, right? We don't know their genetics. We don't know what they make necessarily. We don't know even how many we eat when we make a fermented food. And so they're really fundamentally different, fermented, the microbes in fermented foods and probiotics.
Now, I totally understand the need to define kind of like the territory and understand and get a handle on what claims you can make or you know, the verification of somebody's hypotheses. But it also feels to me, I mean, especially when, you know, as someone who came to fermentation as an artisan, as like a maker and a crafter, and then kind of fell into the science myself, you know, it also, you know, kind of rings in my mind that while science looked to fermented foods first to discover all these strains in the first place, and then goes back around, isolates them, and, you know, starts to making claims about what they can or cannot do. And full disclosure, I work for one of the largest probiotic companies on earth. I work for Christian Hansen, which just celebrated its 150th year anniversary and has subsequently merged with Novozymes yesterday and become a new company. You know, and I know from being inside the corporation, they are very interested in what can or cannot be classified a probiotic. You see this all the time with small startups and probiotic and you know, the rise of all of these health companies that need to rely on the ability to make health claims to make lots of money. Do you feel like there is a possibility that these definitions could change in the coming years as moneyed interests start to get more and more involved in the conversation? And it goes away from just pure science and more towards, you know, a bottom line and what you can or cannot tell a consumer?
We're already seeing new terms to, I guess, refine this probiotic concept, like next generation probiotics or live biotherapeutic products. At one point, it seemed like the word probiotic was a bad word to use because it's been soiled in some way. Really, what I would, you know, like to see is that we come up from maybe the other angle in good microbes or friendly microbes or some other more creative way of describing this, that there could be common properties of the microbes in fermented foods or the products that they make in fermented foods, like lactic acid, just for example, that can be beneficial for our health. Right now, we don't have that. And I think we should look in that direction rather than trying to retool, I think, a very functional definition, you know, the word probiotic, which, you know, has been defined by the World Health Organization and it's been sort of well established, and right, we could have a critique of probiotics, but I think generally what we should be looking at is preserving that definition of being strain level specificity for probiotics and instead kind of explore how we can convey to consumers that the microbes generally and their products generally could be good for our health.
No, I totally understand what you mean about kind of, you know, having specific definitions, but also broadening the scope of, you know, consumers' understanding. You know, it kind of, not to get too far into the theory here, but it kind of reminds me of, I'm reading a book by Nick Lane right now, who spent a lot of time studying microbes, his book about oxygen and oxidative stress in the human body and things like that. And he harks back to this really great study that talked about the impact of vitamin C on human health from, I think, like the late 90s or early 2000s. And the media completely blew it out of proportion and said that like mega doses of vitamin C could like decrease mortality by 50% or something. And the actual, you know, scientists that worked on the study had to fight back against the way their study was being picked up and said, we made no correlation with, you know, the supplements and things like that. Like, you cannot draw the conclusion. We looked at a subset of people that had a diet rich in lots of fruits and vegetables and tracked the amount of vitamin C that they were intaking from these whole foods and saw that they had these positive health outcomes. And all we looked at from all that food intake was vitamin C. That's the correlation. There's obviously a lot more going on there. And vitamin C kind of stands as, you know, this beacon within that complex system that you then see a result with. I wonder if fermentation kind of works the same way, where we know that lots of these microbes live in these fermented foods. We know that some of them can be classified as probiotics, but that these larger ecologies within these living foods carry with them some benefits that, yes, you could isolate one strain and say this has a probiotic benefit, but when you get the whole package, you know, there might be things that you can't so easily kind of pick out of the chorus to talk about specifically. So that kind of leads me into the next question. Are there examples of microbes that are considered probiotic but generally aren't found in fermented foods, or vice versa?
Actually, we would not go to fermented foods to isolate a probiotic. We would tend and go to fecal samples or samples from collective from people. It doesn't have to be stool, it can be skin or other, you know, sites. We would want to isolate microbes that we think could do well in where we're putting them. And so that is a big distinction. Not to say we couldn't find probiotic strains in fermented foods, but that they would have to, like any, have to be tested individually in human studies to be verified, confer some sort of health benefit. But I agree with you, you know, there's the product is really greater, can be greater than the sum of its parts. And so when we kind of deconstruct down in a very reductionist view of the components of anything, I think we lose the picture of the whole. So I really appreciate your point about vitamin C, because there is a tendency to really simplify when foods are ultimately very complex with many bioactive constituents and nutrients that our bodies need.
And lastly, are there legal requirements surrounding the use of the term probiotic? Is it somehow restricted, or would you get penalized if you were like a small batch, you know, artisan producer and you're at a farmer's market and you put probiotic on the label of your living food?
Yeah, that really depends on where you live and the national laws governing food regulations in that country or region. In the U.S., we're pretty hands-off at this point in using the terms. And, you know, that is a problem for consumers to really know what they're getting when they get a food or a supplement. On the other hand, in Europe, EFSA has been kind of the other end of the spectrum and really restricting the use of the word probiotic. Really, yogurt can be considered probiotic based on EFSA's rulings. And so, you know, it really is going to be country and region specific.
David, the example you gave is actually, I've run into that at the farmer's market where I've talked to people that are selling products and they have probiotic on the label. And, you know, we'll start having a conversation. I'll say, well, you know, why don't you put just wild fermentation on here? And they're like, no, it won't sell. We have to use the term probiotic. And so it's been interesting to kind of, you know, talk about the distinction there. But there's also the opposite happening where there are companies now that really want to have probiotic on their soda, for example. And so it's not uncommon to have like gut healthy drinks where it's just, you know, a carbonated soda, but then they just add B subtilis at the end and are able to call it a probiotic gut healthy drink. Maria, I know that you've also published a paper on looking at kind of a daily microbial intake and quantifying the amount of microbes that we might actually need and kind of looking at, you know, when do we know we've had enough? Is there kind of an upper limit? And so I was interested in hearing about that and the distinction between fermented product at a store that people would buy and a products with added probiotics in them that are still a food product.
Yeah, I think what you're seeing is that we're looking for ways to describe just eating friendly or non-harmful good microbes, right? That is the space we're in of trying to evolve or develop these terms, and, you know, ultimately back it up with, you know, is there something there, right, science, you know, to understand the microbes we're exposed to that aren't causing harm to our bodies. Just this, go back to this term probiotic, it's really contentious. You know, we recognize it at these, if we hear the word probiotic, we think, oh, this is good, right? This is good for us. And this idea has really evolved, grown in the U.S. over the past 15 years or so. I guess even going on to 20 years. And so, yeah, there's the real temptation to put probiotic in a label, even though it has no real, you know, significance. I mean, it's just a familiar term. So, yeah, to find new ways to describe these microbes we'd be encountering in our foods. And I'm really glad you brought up this live microbes project. it was Colin Hill at the University of College Cork, so in Cork, who wrote a perspective piece and very eloquently explained, you know, why aren't we considering this? As I said earlier, the bacteria we would find in a sauerkraut are going to be relatives to probiotic strains that have been tested in multiple clinical studies. And so that, you know, then broadened the perspective of bringing in concepts like the old friends hypothesis or the hygiene hypothesis, that exposures to non-harmful microbes in our environment can help guide our immune system and potentially lead to fewer inflammatory diseases or allergies. And, you know, so, you know, particularly early in life, how to answer that question in foods, because foods would be really the primary way we get exposure to microbes, with majority of our mucosal immune system located in sampling and in our digestive tract. Foods would be a primary way we come into contact with these non-harmful microbes. And so to get our toes wet in this concept, we looked at NHANES, which is a large database in the U.S. where as a survey across the U.S. population and dietary intake and health metrics like weight and cholesterol and immune markers and so on. And so in that database, there's like 9,000 food codes of what people were eating when they were participating in this survey. And so we went through these 9,000 different kinds of foods to look at which foods contain high numbers of microbes when we would eat those foods, medium and low. And it's a very crude metric, as is when you take dietary records. It's a difficult thing to do and you know, describing what people eat. But it did allow that first step to see if there is an association between microbes in our diets and health. Interestingly, you know, or maybe in a way not surprisingly, there are benefits by association with reduction of risk for cardiovascular disease. So I think this idea is sort of taking off, is particularly because with the robust data set like you have in NHANES, it allows you can look at different biomarkers at different stages in life, and so you can explore. That doesn't take away the need to do actual studies where we quantify the number of microbes people are eating and then follow their health. So I think maybe I lost the thread of your question, but again, I'm excited about this type of work.
No, totally. I mean, yeah, I do think that the idea of quantifying the daily intake of microbes, but also kind of understanding what the recommended minimum would be, but also the recommended upper limit. Again, going back to these products where they're just kind of throwing in a certain amount of probiotics and just, you know, say, look, we're better because we have 100 trillion, you know, microbes in this, and kind of understanding really what the limits are, even in terms of health benefits. Because the other part of it too is that when you're consuming a probiotic, you might be getting a much higher dose at once than if you're consuming a fermented food, for example, over time, where the amount of viable microbes might be decreasing over time, even though you might still have that increase in metabolites. And so it's kind of understanding the differences between those two, which I think is really, really interesting.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And you're right on all accounts. There are, of course, these products where Bacillus subtilis, or, you know, its adder, is added in at the end when being packaged and being an endospore-forming microbe, you know, it's really tolerant and can survive many places. But what is the actual benefit for an individual if you want to call it a probiotic? And you know, similarly, in a fermented food, you don't know if necessarily those microbes are alive when you eat it. But going back to David's point, you know, it's really the sum of, or maybe even greater than the sum of the parts. And so I think it's going to take going into looking at individual fermented foods like we would with yogurt. And that's one that has had more attention in the scientific community and in research. Fewer studies on other fermented foods like sauerkraut or sourdough bread, and, you know, and there's so many other fermented foods out there that we can be investigating. And it might ultimately just come down to some really basic principles or commonalities that we're going to have to draw some between different fermented food types and different microbes. It's a very rich area. There's a lot of questions to ask.
I know. I'm also, there's a specific product that I always think about that claims to have the equivalent in whatever the size bottle of microbes as the entire gut microbiome. And so you'd expect it to weigh, you know, a few pounds, but it is just like a little bottle. And so I always find that really funny, where just when you have a sense of scale, you look at that and you're like, that is absolutely, you know, that's not even close. But yeah, it just, you know, they have X amount of CFUs in there, but it should be weighing, you know, at least 2-3 pounds. So.
Yeah, I think some of, when we just talk about numbers, we lose the key point. If we eat, heck, 0157H7, we only need to eat, you know, 100, 10 to 100 cells to get sick. Why are we so focused on numbers? I think we should be focused on potency of the microbe.
But also, you know, the more I learn about microbiology, the more I'm kind of fascinated with just how intricate it is. But it's also, you know, pathogenicity and the ability to be a common cell sometimes is context dependent, you know, on so many external factors. And that's something that, you know, I often talk about the human microbiome as many commonalities as they are in between individuals and populations and people in the same household and all of this, is that, you know, everyone has their own unique fingerprint, but imagine the fingerprint moving like a hurricane, changing from second to second. You see the complexity kind of spill out that way. But working at UC Davis, if I could ask you about this, you know, me living across the Atlantic, you know, when I think of any university and any campus that is associated with food studies in the United States, and that provenance, I think of UC Davis. I mean, Ariel Johnson, the one who taught me almost everything I know about microbes, studied there as well. So obviously it comes with a great reputation, also in agricultural studies, wine. There must be a lot of producers coming through and interacting with the faculty there. How has your work with Lactiaceae bacteria kind of met industry and food producers, and do they also influence your research and you know, kind of give you clues as directions to follow?
Yeah, that's a great question. Really, the reason I work on fermented foods at all is I visited the companies in Northern California that make fermented olives when I started back in 2008. It was like the first field trip I took was to visit these small companies. They're the only ones in the U.S. that make fermented olives. They're usually a particular kind, the Sevillano, the big green ones that are frequently filled with cheese and garlic and so on. Very long history there. And they had a problem in that they had huge losses to their product and they didn't have a way to fix it. And they couldn't predict when it would happen again. So whole livelihoods, whole businesses, you know, going under because of the defect. And I was convinced that it wasn't microbial. but we took some of the olives with us and compared them, looked at the microbes and inoculated the microbes. We isolated back into the olives and found, lo and behold, this was a microbially caused problem due to a pectomelitic yeast that just happened to be stochastically more abundant on those olives that year. And, you know, that really got me hooked. in Europe, where I was doing my postdoc, and there's a very rich and developed science around fermented foods and lactic acid bacteria. And, you know, here in the U.S., a lot of my predecessors left the field mainly because of funding. But, you know, seeing this as such a pivotal, important part of the livelihood and the economy of California, and, you know, could be more broadened across the U.S., and digging deeper into it, I learned that really some of the foundational work in the U.S. on lactic acid bacteria and food fermentations was done at Davis. So out of that experience and working with fermented olives, you know, I just saw so many opportunities to make a new product or improve or diversify and like expand the business, expand the fermented foods sector in our supermarket, particularly in the cold section where we have like microbes still there. But that's not what they need. I mean, they really just needed ways to make sure that their product doesn't have defects. And that's a real constraint. If, you know, if you look at agriculture, it's very subject to the weather, right? If it rains or it's too cold, you know, you lose your crop. It's the same thing with fermented foods. They're very subject to the microbes. These are living foods. And so, yeah, your livelihood is sort of dependent on the unknown, and the unknown is very uncomfortable. And so we work on fermented olives and cheese as well. You know, even though cheese, we make cheese using starter cultures or defined microbes we add in, there's all kinds of defects with cheese. And so as much as I'd like to see new products on our supermarket shelves, I think we're still at the point of trying to help the fermenters, the processors, just make sure they have a product to sell.
So you're a little bit a superhero in the fermented foods community then, right? You telling me this story also, I read the years ago Bruno Latour's book, The Pasteurization of France. And you remind me of this saying that history doesn't repeat itself, but it sure does rhyme. this was Pasteur's origin story. He was in Lille investigating, like asking brewers and vendors, like, well, why are you losing all these batches? And as a chemist, he was diving into it to be like, how can we fix this? How can we help you get rid of these defects? And lo and behold, helps to birth the entire field of microbiology. So, yeah, hallowed ground. You've already talked a little bit about this, but, you know, and I followed it as soon as you launched it on Instagram, and I loved following Eat LAC, evaluating and testing lacto ferments around the country. What's next for this project?
Thanks so much for following us. And this is one of my favorite projects we've had. And so I've been together with Aaron DiCaprio, who's in our food science department as well, and is an extension specialist. And we were thinking of how we can, first of all, help people who make their own fermented foods at home by developing recipes and best practices for making fermented fruits and vegetables. The kind of bench component of what we're doing in the laboratory really shifted because of the pandemic when we couldn't be in the lab. So instead, we set up our own fermentations in our kitchens using the same recipe and same ingredients. And I have probably no surprise to you, the ferments were very different from one another, even within our own, on our own countertops. So, we were finding how these microbes, just by chance come up in different times and give us very different products. And we launched Eat LAC Community Science Project, where we were inviting folks from all over to send us their fresh fermented fruits and vegetables so we could query what kind of microbes are in there. And we did that through DNA sequencing and shared the results and with those who submitted the samples. And again, no surprise, they're very different microbes, some mainly lactic acid bacteria, but that's a very, very like 37,000 foot view. And lastly, in this project, we performed a national survey to ask what people are thinking about fermented foods. Are they making it at home? Can they recognize what a fermented food is? What kind of resources they would like to have? And can imagine the findings of that survey and our home ferments and leading into all kinds of new projects. So what is next? We are looking to focus more on fermented peppers and berries, again, to develop some recipes and to look at regional differences. But also, ultimately I see hopefully opening a market for making more fermented foods commercially available, particularly these fresh fermented fruits and vegetables that have such a long tradition, and the kind of ferments we receive from people are so different, but we can't find them in the supermarket, right? They're not accessible. So how do we do that? How do we make these foods so that, frankly, could just go to the supermarket and buy it if we don't have time to make it ourselves or don't have that tradition? So I'd really love to see that happen in not too many years.
Maria, maybe connected to this, I mean, that there's such so much momentum in the fermented food space right now. And of course, major manufacturers are getting interested. And Aliza mentioned before the, kind of either fermentation or mock fermentation where some surrogate, spore-forming microbe is added at the end so it can, the manufacturers can say contain live microbes or contains probiotics. And of course, I think the artisanal route and kind of local producers is what appeals to so many of us that are following this space and understand where quality comes from and everything. What do you see as the future in terms of the marketplace and how this plays out in large scale around the world as fermented food trends continue to kind of, take off and expand?
That's a challenging question, right? Because when you're a very successful small artisan company, you can be bought out by a very large company, and then you the nature of your business fundamentally changes. I always think there'll be a need or a niche for these smaller companies, products that are being innovative and kind of pushing the boundaries. On the other hand, we need foods that are not too expensive that can be accessed by people on limited incomes, and by having good tasting foods,
right? And so, you know, in a practical sense, I think there will be that tension between, you know, the boutique, the small artisan companies, which are very valuable and important locally or in a community, and then feeding people in food service, for example.
Awesome. We've covered a lot of ground today, from the first cultured microbe to bacteria producing electricity and as they conduct their metabolism and try to get rid of electrons. If you are speaking to a young trainee that's following the fermentation space, or even, you know, somebody who's just a fan and wants to understand where the field is going, what do you see across the field as kind of the most exciting direction for fermented food research?
Well, certainly your work, Justin, has caught the attention of the public on health, right? And, your lab's work really put a spotlight on the benefits we may see of eating a fermented food over a fiber. Wow. That was cool. I know. I absolutely. I think we are riding on that momentum of exploring the space of how fermented foods can benefit our health, and you know, even deconstructing that into individual food types or the constituents, the microbes or the metabolites that they're making, and you know, the reliability or the consistency across ferments can be potentially guiding dietary recommendations in the not too distant future. So for those who are interested in health, you know, that is certainly a huge opportunity and space I would guide somebody. And those who are interested in more making or helping processors, there's so much to explore in the ecology of these food fermentations. It's just been fascinating how different strains of the same species coexist in a food fermentation, and that's sort of against Darwin. So, I mean, there's a lot to be explored from both ends of that spectrum of just making the foods all the way to after we eat them.
As we were sitting here, I got a text from a chef at Stanford, Andrew Main, who's a great fermenter, and he was offering to drop off some farm kraut by the lab. So that's just to, you know, it's funny as we're sitting here talking about fermentation to realize that there's a pending delivery of wonderful fresh fermented food. I'm wondering if, you know, so this will be in my fridge or in the lab's fridge over the coming week, and we'll eat it. What does your fridge look like for fermented food? If we were to open it up, what's in there, and what do you eat?
You know, to me, it's very normal, but I have olives, I have yogurt, cheese, kimchi, hot sauces, kombucha, you know, bread, sourdough bread, mainstay. Mainly it's because I lived in Europe for 6 years. I came back, was just like, I just love it. My kids like drink the sauerkraut container brine. I don't know. It's normal to us, but maybe not to them.
Fantastic. No, that's awesome. And then, you know, as a UC Davis alum, I'm always, you know, I love to keep up the food community, the microbiology community up there is just amazing. And I'm wondering, can you give us just a quick sneak peek of maybe something we haven't heard about that's next in your lab, a next big goal or something local that's going on there that's exciting?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, fortunate I'm positioned there, right, next to the vineyards and the viticulture enology department, and there's always something exciting happening at Davis, so you should come over. happy to show you around. For our own work, we're really getting into this connection between the metabolites, the secreted compounds in fermented foods made by these microbes or released by these microbes and their influence on our health and our intestine. And, I think maybe some commonality in that, but it's just been fascinating to see what the difference is between cabbage and sauerkraut. They're night and day. They're totally different. And so the same thing we could say for fermented milk to fermented milk or yogurt. What are the metabolites? What is the effector compound in or compounds in these foods? And it's probably, you know, a complex story. It's multifactorial.
Awesome. So where can listeners read more about your work, find you, connect with you on social media? Do you want to just give a little shout out to your the ways you communicate your science?
Yeah, sure. So you can follow me on LinkedIn at Maria Almarco. We do have an X or normally Twitter account, Marco Lab UC Davis. You know, otherwise, they can always shoot me an email or phone call. I'm happy to talk.
Amazing. I can't thank you enough for joining us. I mean, it's just you're bringing your knowledge to this podcast is an incredible addition. So thanks for spending the time with us today.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Maria.
Thank you so much. It was really cool.
Thank you so much for joining us for our conversation with Maria Marco. For more information, visit us at go2.stanford.edu/fermentation series, or just search for Fermentation Speaker Series Stanford on any search engine and sign up for our newsletter. For more conversations like this one, please subscribe on Spotify. If you have any questions, ideas, or comments, we do want to hear from you, so email us at fermentationseries@gmail.com. Music by Sam Fisher. Special thanks to Monica Cryan for her support.